Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, producer picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during the week. On today's show...
That is one of the major problems, in my opinion,
okay,
is that nurses don't have enough input into how the care is delivered. And, you know, every hospital board should have a nurse.
They don't?
Many of them do not.
We feature Monday's episode with Dr. Annette Wasacki, the Dean of the School of Nursing at the University at Buffalo. And we'll close with...
You know, for being someone that's been engaged in this for quite some time now, I can see that sometimes progress can be very difficult to attain, because a lot of it is you may have people that are interested, that want to get involved, but before you can get them to that point of being politically or civically engaged, you have to address other barriers that they experience in their life, right? So...
Wednesday's episode with Alex Burgos and Talia Rodriguez, two advocates for the local Western New York Hispanic community. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Dr. Annette Wasacki, the Dean of the School of Nursing at the University at Buffalo. The two discussed how to better support nurses, who she views as one of the most needed yet least supported professions.
Absolutely. There is a lot in this particular topic here that we're going to get into. I'm thrilled because your experience really runs the gamut here to a certain extent. And let's just take a moment to dive into it. Though I call you Dr. Wasacki, you got into this field as a registered nurse, correct?
I did. I started my career actually after graduating from nursing school in North Carolina. I went to University of Virginia in Charlottesville and began my career working on a oncology surgical unit, and then worked in a burn unit there. And that's, of course, what then led me to eventually have a research career in wound healing research and making some discoveries that then impacted how we care for wounds today.
When I talk about the honesty and ethics and these polls, what do you think about that? What do you see in terms of a connection between what a registered nurse is doing on the front line and what the perception of the public is? How does that make sense to you, that nurses stand out above lawyers, doctors, teachers?
Well, I mean, it seems very obvious to us, I think, in nursing. And I think that's because, as you may know, 86% of the face-to-face time with a patient is with a nurse. And so we are the ones that are continuously there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days of the year, taking care of patients. And so we come to observe your health condition. We know if things aren't going well for you. We understand what are the treatments that we are responsible for delivering, as well as the care that we provide independently on our own. And so because we are there listening, watching, observing throughout that time continuously, then that's why we, I think, are the most trusted profession, because patients know they can depend on the nurse who is there 24 hours a day should something arise or they have a concern and or a deterioration of their condition. So I think that is why it's more than well deserved that we have been trusted for so long by the American public. And actually, it's been for more than 20 years, and actually longer than 20 years, with the exception of the year of 9/11 when it was firefighters. And even up until that time, nurses were also rated the highest. So we, again, are the ones that are there to really monitor what's happening. We're sort of like the canaries in that coal mine.
And I want to be kind of careful how I phrase this particular question. I don't want to cast a wide judgment when it comes to the medical field. But I would think, in a lot of ways, overall, when it comes to medical concerns or healthcare issues and the treatment thereof, that the overall field probably doesn't get that high of a mark when it comes to ethics. And I even see on, I think, doctors, going back to the same poll, I see that they have fallen 14% in this very poll as well. Again, compare and contrast. What's going on with that? You know, nurses, people think highly of them, but yet maybe their surroundings aren't as well, you know, seen as honest or as ethical. I mean, how do you make that? What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's probably the perception of patients is that physicians are there just intermittently for very brief periods of time, and so they don't understand that the care and concern and the empathetic compassion is there from physicians, and I think they then see them as not. And then I think also they're sometimes directing or instructing or telling them things without giving them an opportunity to ask questions and or to voice their concerns because they are doing it in such a rapid pace. I think that's where nurses have a real role to play because patients are in a very vulnerable situation when they're in an unfamiliar environment, and especially if they've not been hospitalized before. So nurses are the ones that can help understand what are their concerns, help them understand what are the questions they should be asking. What are the things that they need to know and how to return and restore their health? So that, you know, that's also one of the major differences between physicians versus nurses is physicians are focused on the diagnosis and treatment of disease. Nurses are focused on the promotion and restoration of health. And that's our primary calling. And so, of course, when you think about the time of a patient in the hospital, you are there primarily for nursing care. That is the bulk of the care you receive is nursing care.
Yeah, I would say most people don't think of it that way, do they?
No, they probably don't. I mean, they may be there for a surgical procedure, but once the surgery is completed, then it's the nurses who are helping you promote and restore you back to a healthy situation so we can discharge you, send you home, do whatever the necessary follow-up care is with a home care nurse and or to help you then return to, you know, living.
Take me through. I know it's been probably a while since you've been on the floor, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But to take me through what a nurse might do in their 8 or 10, some do 12-hour shifts yes. These days. Take me through a little bit of what that might be like.
Well, for I think most people, depending on the facility where you're at, you might start off your shift with a verbal report or a handoff, depending on if you're a critical care versus a unit. And so usually there's somebody that's handing off, you know, they are going to you and you're saying, okay, here's the patients that I'll be taking care of today. We go over what are the conditions of the patient, what are their treatments that are we need to make sure we're managing and delivering for the patients, whether it's a wound care treatment, whether it's watching vital signs, what are the drugs and therapeutics that will be delivered to the patient. Have there been any responses that have not been normal? So we start off usually our day with understanding as we're doing a handoff from one shift to the next. And then each nurse always goes in and assesses that patient at the beginning of their shift to understand what is their current condition, has anything changed, is there anything I need to do immediately, so we can automatically start to prioritize amongst the patients we're taking care of. I can give you a for instance. I remember
sure.
One time I've been through many nursing shortages. And I have to say, I remember I'm receiving report. And for some reason, I was one of the more experienced nurses at the time. And I've got every difficult patient there is. I have one patient who's decompensating with oxygen saturation, needs to go to ICU. I have another patient who has a brain tumor and is throwing up and you're concerned about what's going on with them. And then I have one other person who's being treated for cancer and needs platelets.
Wow.
So automatically I have to prioritize. So after getting report, I quickly assess the person, you know, for me, the person who was decompensating with their oxygen and needed to go to ICU to be on a respirator, they had a family member in the room, and I checked on them. They were at least alert. They were oriented, and even though they were not in the best of condition and they were turning a little bluish, they were cognizant. I walked into the patient with the brain tumor who was throwing up. No one was in the room, and the patient was on their back. And then you're concerned about aspiration. So I turned this patient on their side so that they could, you know, be safe while I was doing other things, making sure checking with them because I'd also checked on the patient who needed the platelets. And again, at least they were alert oriented, and yes, they needed to get the platelets, but it wasn't an emergency that needed. So sometimes these are the types of of fast-paced environments where nurses have to make snap judgments about which patient you need to prioritize and who needs what kind of care, and then recognizing that safety. So then throughout our shift, we're constantly, you know, taking care of these patients in many ways. And again, I've worked in, as I think I might have mentioned, I worked in a burn unit right. as part of my early career. And of course, that sometimes that is so intense because you're also in my time in working in the burn unit, I also did wound debridements. And we used to use Hubbard tanks where we would take the patient to the Hubbard tank and debride these wounds. The nurses did all of that work. And so I, you know, you're constantly prioritizing what you need to do, whether you have, you know, wound care that needs, that you're taking care of. And many of the, you know, those decisions around wound care, or nurses are deciding what types of dressings and treatments might be needed to care for that wound. So throughout the day, you're prioritizing whether they might need, and coordinating with the other members of the healthcare team if they need, you know, if they're an asthmatic or COPD, do they need a respiratory treatment? Is the respiratory therapist supposed to be there? Is the physical therapist supposed to be there? So you're making sure and coordinating the entire healthcare team for that, for every patient you're taking care of. So it's very fast-paced environment today. And so that's typically, and then we go through our entire shift monitoring, always looking at your vital signs, checking, making sure there's no complications, and then reporting on to the next shift who comes behind us. So that's just sort of a little sampling, perhaps, of what might happen on a shift.
Yeah, it's a breathtaking amount of work and responsibility. I think that's what really stuck out there, that you are making these decisions, and I don't want to discount the teamwork involved, but I'll probably reference more than once in this program, you know, I spent many months in a recent in recent years with my parents and hospitals and saw a lot of this, but the nurses were available. Trying to track down a doctor, and I don't want to sit here and criticize doctors and make it sound like that, but the point is, you're trying to make you work with a team, but yet at the same time, that team also might be scattered about and doing all sorts of other things. So you have to make these types of decisions. That's quite a responsibility.
No, it is. It is a huge responsibility, which is why the level of education has, you know, greatly improved. I mean, you know, in the early, at the turn of the century, of course, nursing was almost like an apprenticeship. And then it was in the 19... when the Goldmark report came out, which was in the 1918, 1920, in that period of time, was one of the first reports that came out that then started moving nursing from sort of an apprenticeship system into a university setting. And also along with that, it's parroted along with the types of therapeutics, the drugs that have been developed over time have become so, you know, so much more. Sometimes, you know, we are titrating those drugs or balancing patients on the edge of life, literally, when we are, especially in critical care areas where we're looking and monitoring blood pressure changes and deviations, and we have a dosage of a drug that a physician has prescribed, and we're deciding exactly how much of that drug to be delivered to that patient, because every patient responds differently. And we know that in some situations, men can tolerate higher doses of a drug than women patients in certain situations. But it's the nurses who observe your response to that therapeutic drug to understand exactly how much to give. And so those are the situations where we are the keen observer of the physiologic response to the therapeutic treatments that can make the difference.
That idea of the dosages of drugs, you told me that before we went on the air, and it's a fascinating part. And again, I'm asking just a conjecture, but how many people outside the nursing profession, and I guess obviously anybody else who works inside the medical profession, would know that nurses are the ones that, you say the doctors prescribe, but the nurses figure out the dose?
Yeah, it's not true for every drug that's given. Okay, for a lot of oral agents and pills and things, yes, that is a set dosage. But I'm thinking about especially drugs that are managing, again, for critical care areas that are given IV.
Right.
That IV dosage is not always clear because, you know, it depends on your body weight and, again, your individual response to the drug. And then, you know, more and more, of course, genetics is coming into this, too. And we know that some people don't metabolize drugs in the same way. And, of course, we're sometimes the astute observers of that response. And we haven't moved to that super point of medicine yet where we are looking at your genetics to understand whether or not you'll respond to a drug in a certain way.
Are we going
to
get there, do you think?
We're getting there. Yeah. And we are there in some ways for some drugs. We do know that. But in other situations, we're not doing that screen routinely for every patient, you know. So I would say mostly these are agents that are given intravenously to in the vein to a patient. Those are the ones where we're titrating doses. And sometimes it's true for pain medications as well, especially, again, if it's an injectable drug or an intravenous pain relief that's being given. Again, we are trying to manage. I mean, I think of another situation where a patient I had got in had came from the recovery room. Somebody had given them some pain relief, but gave a little bit more than they should have. And here's this patient, and, breathing is diminished. They're having like 3 or 4 respirations a minute. They've got pinpoint pupils. And I know right away that this patient needs a dose of Narcan.
Okay.
And so I'm calling the physician on the phone. He's busy attending to emergency at another hospital. And he's like, what does this patient need? And I said, a amp of Narcan. He says, do it.
Hmm.
And, I moved right away to deliver that to the patient to get them back to a stable situation so they had a routine respiratory rate and weren't in trouble. And I remember this physician coming by after his emergency room. And again, this is where sometimes their physicians are trying to manage other emergent situations.
Of course, yes.
And he came and he was just, flowing with compliments about, I'm so glad you were here. I'm so glad you picked up on this and that you observed this. And that's what nurses do. And I think sometimes we take it for granted what we do. And it's sometimes unseen to the public in many ways and under that understanding of what actually we are doing. And I think we do it in a way that we don't alarm patients because it's part of the routine of what we do.
We're talking with Dr. Annette Wysocki. She's the dean of the School of Nursing at the University of Buffalo. We're talking about the nursing profession, some of the perceptions about it. Interesting to find out that most Americans think that when it comes to honesty and ethics, nurses stand on the top. That's good to know. But at the same time, back to what you're saying about the patients, I think that's interesting. A patient really, although obviously very appreciative of what nurses are doing, they might not even know how much the nurse is doing. I'm wondering if there's even like this, I know we're in the year 2025, but I'm wondering if there's like a lot of still kind of old perceptions that, the nurse is, person is just going to come in and, do a couple little things, maybe, change my pillow, whatever, I don't want to soft, but I don't want to do it. But are there still those perceptions that the doctor's the person who is the overseer and the all knowledgeable person, and the nurse is, they're here to help me, I appreciate it. But at the same time, maybe they don't understand the depth of all that goes into that profession.
No, I totally agree, of course. I mean, I think, again, it's a team effort. And again, we are the ones that are also recognizing, when you might be getting into trouble. We're monitoring your breath sounds to know if you're developing early signs of pneumonia, whether or not whether or not your lungs are clearing, all of those things that we do. And actually, we may be in there adjusting your pillow, but we're observing you, your body, and your physiological response simultaneously. And, whether it's multiple, sometimes in critical care areas where you're hanging, might be receiving intravenous fluids, and we're also managing 3 or 4 other drip medications that you're receiving. And again, monitoring those to make sure that you are receiving those in a way that don't drive you into a deterioration. So it's, I think you're right. I think that people don't understand that while, yes, they are doing their part, we're also practicing under our nursing license where we're looking at your physiologic response. And then also we're trying, again, as part of our promotion and restoration of health, trying to help you to get up, move, circulate the blood, understanding that you need to breathe and making sure you're inhaling, taking deep breaths, doing things that are going to help you restore your health. I do think that one of the areas that, all nurses and patients probably distress over is adequate sleep in the hospital.
Right.
But that's so important. And yet hospitals can be noisy environments. And so I think that's been one of the things that nurses have also tried to be attuned to, is trying to create environments to provide better rest and sleep at night, and then not unnecessarily, you know, managing and timing your treatments during the night so we're not unnecessarily waking you or disturbing you. If things, you know, if we can alter some of that scheduling over the night so you can sleep, because we know that during stage four sleep, that's when growth hormone is secreted, which for people especially that have surgery, that's important for tissue healing.
How far do we have to go to get to stage four sleep? I'm curious about that.
I don't know that they refer to it as stage four sleep anymore, but, you know, in the old days, for sure, it's just that's the deepest stage of sleep, when you just really, you know, think of the times when you might have just gotten so exhausted from physical exertion during the day that you put your head on the pillow and you are gone.
Right, right.
Then that, again, is when your body is having those really deep stages of sleep that are restoring. And again, that's when growth hormone is secreted during those deep stages of sleep that's so important to restore your health.
I feel like I don't want to keep putting you on the spot, and I hope you don't feel like that, but I just get the sense as you're talking that nurses have a great understanding of all the needs that are going on their particular units, their hospitals. Are they getting enough input into the way hospitals are run and hospitals are constructed and organized?
That is an excellent question, because that is one of the major problems, in my opinion, is that nurses don't have enough input into how the care is delivered. And, you know, every hospital board should have a nurse.
They don't?
Many of them do not. You know, if you look at these hospital boards, they might be people in the community or another, but every hospital, every medical board should have a nurse on, because today it's not just physicians that are caring for patients, it's physical therapists, nurses. So it shouldn't be a quote medical board. It should be a, you know, a hospital board where everyone, or a professional board where all members of the healthcare team have a voice in making the policies that are going to help operate this hospital. And for far too long, that voice has been a singular voice. But in reality, nurses are the ones that really are operating the hospital, making it work. We are the backbone of the healthcare system. But I think it's also because it's still a primarily women's profession. We have the same lack of acknowledgement. Often our patients acknowledge us and see it better than our colleagues do at times. But I think, as with teachers, nurses, social workers, librarians are probably the people that are the least recognized and sometimes appreciated for what we do for our communities, and also the least supported. But I do think that's an excellent point. And if one of the experiences that I had when I was at the National Institutes of Health as the scientific director for the National Institute of Nursing Research, I was also for a while the clinical director. And because the clinical center at the NIH is run quite differently, because it operates off the budgets of all of the other institutes, then each institute has a voice on the on that medical board that was there at the time. So I was the nurse on the medical board. We had a dentist on the medical board. Most of the other people on that medical board were physicians from the other institutes. But when we were making decisions about the policies, what would be happening at the clinical center at the National Institutes of Health, we all voted and had a voice on those. And I can remember a few times when some decisions were made where I and my dental colleagues were the tying and deciding vote.
Wow.
And so, because there was disagreement even among the physician colleagues. But I always voted based on, you know, principles and ethical centeredness of what the issues were that came before the board. So, but it was an instructional moment, because it made me realize that we are behind the times. The clinical center at NIH in some ways has led where I feel like the future lies in healthcare, where other voices who are also caring for these patients as a team need to be making some of these decisions that are affecting some of how we deliver care to patients.
And you did get into it just a second ago. Still mainly female profession.
Yes.
Do you have any idea what the statistics are on that?
Yeah, so currently there was a time when about 9% of nurses were men, and then currently that number's actually come up to almost 12% now, men. And I would say here at University of Buffalo, actually, we're doing a little bit better than that. We have about 15% of our students are male students, so we are ahead of that curve. And I think largely because today more men are coming into nursing because they want to move along the pathway of becoming an advanced practice provider as a nurse practitioner, whether it's a family nurse practitioner, adult gerontology nurse practitioner, pediatric nurse practitioner, a nurse anesthetist, or a nurse midwife. I mean, there are many other advanced practice roles in nursing now, and I think that's starting to attract a lot more men into nursing. When I poll our students, when they come to our School of Nursing at University of Buffalo, I often ask them, you know, what do you want to do? And then I ask them, you know, what if they have any idea. And then sometimes I say, and how many of you want to be nurse practitioners? And almost every hand in the class goes up.
Really?
So I think many people are, and I think it makes sense for many reasons. As the therapeutic advances have been made around genetics and the types of drugs we're delivering, immune-based therapies today, that level of education and that level of how we're going to be delivering care needs to be leveled up. And so in some ways, that we maybe reach a time far into the future where every nurse is a nurse practitioner.
Wow. Well, you left me at an intriguing point, but we need to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about that. A lot to get into, as you can hear, when it comes to nursing, and we have the right person here, the dean of the School of Nursing at the University of Buffalo, Dr. Annette Wasacki. This morning, we talked a little earlier about how Americans see nurses at the highest regard when it comes to honesty and ethics. Yet there are other issues inside the nursing field that are, I think, kind of not, I guess in some ways, stand opposite that, and not the least of which is the nursing shortage. According to one study, by the year 2027, this country is going to be 300,000 short when it comes to registered nurses. Is that right?
That's correct. So we have a potential looming shortage of registered nurses, and largely because we don't have enough faculty in schools of nursing.
Oh, okay.
And so that's each year we turn away, you know, we could easily, there are many people that apply, but we also turn away people that we would have accepted, but we don't have the faculty. So each year we turn away at least 65,000 students every year from schools of nursing because of inadequate numbers of faculty. Sometimes we don't have enough classroom space. Sometimes we don't have enough clinical placements with our clinical partners. And, you know, so, and then we just don't have, again, the resources to educate students. So that's one of our primary issues in nursing, is the inadequate resources.
So there is an interest. There is enough people interested?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, every school of nursing could probably take double the numbers of students that they do easily.
Okay. How many people apply to your school of nursing?
We have a pretty, you know, large number of applications. And I have to say, the scientific rigor required to be a nurse today is unlike in prior times. And again, it's because of the advanced therapeutics and all of that. So we accept quite a number of students into UB. And I would say for us, somewhere between 20 to 40% or more sometimes of these students, they cannot pass the science requirements. So nursing today is while it's holistic, nursing is about the science, the physiology, the biochemistry, it's about pharmacology, and it's also as well about the social needs of patients, which are the humanities. So I tell my nursing students when they come that there are three things they have to accomplish. They have to be a scientist, they have to be a humanist, and they have to be an ethicist to be a nurse.
Wow.
And those are what I tell students every year when I welcome them to the School of Nursing, because it requires all of those dimensions in order for you to become an expert, proficient nurse to deliver care that's compassionate and then, again, is driving the recovery of those patients and promoting their health.
During the pandemic, we heard about nurses getting burned out.
Yes.
Getting out of the field.
Yeah.
What was at the core of that?
I think a lot of that was because, you know, one of my colleagues, and you might have heard this in the press, where a lot of nurses feel like we went from heroes to zeros.
Hmm.
And that is that we were there doing things that no other member of the healthcare team was doing often. We were the only ones going into the room to see the patient, to hold the patient's hand, to try to communicate with families during some of the worst parts of the pandemic. I remember a nurse at, I was not here in Buffalo, I was out on Long Island at the time, and I remember one of the faculty at the School of Nursing talking about, who was also a nurse practitioner working in critical care and, of course, taking care of these patients with COVID, and she's talking about how she's writing things, pasting signs onto the window, the physician's behind the window, not in the room, asking for orders, telling him what this patient needs to write an order so she can give a drug or do something for this patient. Mm. How nurses had to innovate around doing things like, they were the ones who were taught, who, you know, using iPads, using cell phones to try to at least have communication between patients and families. Nurses were also innovating around understanding, okay, if I take and put on multiple extensions onto my intravenous fluid tubing, then I could put some of this outside so that it can minimize some of the time for people to be in the room to create, and then also for the pharmacy and other people to try to help manage some of those drips that are going on in the room. So I think it's those times, because nurses do some of the most, that's where I'm talking about the humanism and the ethics of nursing. We do some of the hard emotional work with patients, and that hard emotional work is helping people sometimes make life or death decisions for themselves in the most extreme situations. I can remember another story that I, from another faculty member I had who also was a nurse practitioner working during the COVID, where it turns out that both a father and a son came to the hospital, and they just, you know, she, the father's like, well, my son's here. So she got both the father and the son together in the same room. Unfortunately, they both expired. Mm. During the COVID pandemic. But again, it's that attention to trying to make the worst situation the best possible. But it's an emotional work that we do with patients during this time, and especially when things aren't going well. And then trying to reckon with your own death is not easy. But nurses are the ones who are often having those conversations with patients. And that's where the humanistic and the ethical aspects of what we do are so important. And we're always so trying to meet patients on their terms, not our terms, not how we grew up and our orientation to the world, but trying to understand what is your orientation to the world, what are your values, and then helping you reflect and understand how you can meet that on your terms.
That was Dr. Annette Wasacki, the Dean of the School of Nursing at the University at Buffalo. We'll close today's show out with Alex Burgos and Talia Rodriguez, two leaders in the Western New York Hispanic community. The two sit down with Jillian Hainsworth to discuss the Hispanic vote in Western New York.
So let's just jump in. How do you feel when it comes to being classified as one voter block in general?
I think the Hispanic community and our voter base has grown incredibly unique over the years as engagement has changed locally, statewide, and nationally. But I think many people would argue that we are not a voter block at this point. We represent a diverse segment of voters that, we even talked about this on the phone. There was data from Univision from this past cycle that indicated that Hispanic voters, up to 60% of them, don't necessarily have any loyalty to either party, and that they could be swayed by any platform or candidate that appealed to the issues that they cared about. And so Hispanic voters don't necessarily function as a block anymore. They function as a segment of people that are voting based on the issues that directly impact their lived experience.
Yes, so that was very succinct, Alex. I'm so proud of him. That was a fantastic answer. And as he alluded, we've had a lot of conversations, Jill, about how our community voted or will continue to vote. And one of the privileges that I had was writing a column on it. And I told, in one of the intro sentences, I told people, we are no longer a voting block, but like mini voting roadblocks. Because I think that when I was doing research and in conversation with Alex and other community leaders, the economy was the number one issue that was resonating with the Latino voters that were polled, right? Even throughout the United States. And then secondarily, you see a lot of a lot of change of opinion around issues that impact different identities, like how Hispanic males are voting versus Hispanic females, mm-hmm. and even within age range also.
And where can this column be found?
Okay, Jill, thank you. Jill's like, don't you come know, here, waste my time. Absolutely. So my column is in the local Latino newspapers here. It's also on Swell, which I would love to talk to you more about. It's a micro podcast platform and on my website. But yeah, I would love to talk with you more about just what that process was like, because it was a lot of eclectic research.
Yeah, so you said that like a lot of people are not necessarily beholden to one political party or mm-hmm. another, which I love to hear, because I feel like sometimes we find ourselves in really sticky situations when we just vote along party lines, regardless of what the party is saying they're going to do, what they have historically showed us they were willing or able to do. Mm-hmm. So aside from parties, like we're not going to talk about being a Democrat right now, but we are in... we're supposed to be in a democracy, right? Our country is a democracy. It's designed that way, and right. we're hoping that we can keep it that way.
Right.
But paint a picture for me of what an ideal democracy looks like.
That's such a good question. Alex, do you want to go first?
I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind, I feel like the golden era was Obama, at least in my lifetime.
Yes. And for me, I love that answer, because shout out to him. And I had the privilege of being in D.C. serving as an intern in federal government at that time. And there was a lot of beautiful energy in D.C. But for me, a healthy democracy involves voices of many ages. Specifically, a healthy democracy, in my view, Jill, centers the voices of our youth. Like, that's the democracy that I think we need to have. And then also, because I know you know me, I'm going to add delicious food. Because in democracy is hard work. We need to feed people, right? Mm-hmm. So having the eclectic conversation and the diverse conversation be reflective in the culture that we're living to mm-hmm. while we're taking breaks from that hard work.
Nice.
I also think, too, education is really like the biggest thing. You know, if you're looking in the Hispanic community, oftentimes our children are going to the most disinvested schools. And that sets the tone, not just in our community, but overall where our democracy is headed. If people don't have any recollection of the process by which we got to where we're at now, to have the rights that we are afforded today, to the democracy, to the, you know, civic unrest and protest that afforded people like us more rights, then we'll never understand what being engaged in a truly democratic process means. So that's why when people say they want to strip DEI, or they want to defund the Department of Education, or leave it to the states, or this and that, that becomes very dangerous.
Yeah.
Right? And particularly book bans, mm-hmm. which are disproportionately impacting both segments of my identity, mm-hmm. you know, being a person of color, Latino, and being a member of the LGBT community, we're seeing how not only misinformation, but the removal of information altogether can become very dangerous and insidious.
Yeah, I mean, historically, the good guys have never been the ones to ban the books, right? It's always been the bad guys.
Yeah, they don't usually make the books, I feel like, Jill.
Exactly.
So, yeah, they're not the ones.
So,
yeah, I think I feel similarly. We were talking about the research showing that healthy democracy is held up by healthy local news. Mm-hmm. Having news that's generated at the city level by diverse voices statistically impacts the democratic environment and the health of democracy in that city. And there's been people who have overlaid the amount of different newspapers with what voting trends look like. And, you know, having those spaces and spaces like you're making for people to come to be involved in politics in ways that they feel affirming, that are circulating in their community, I think is really powerful.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Alex, you said the Obama era to you was like the golden era. What about that era like sticks out to you? Because for me, like one of my favorite eras, and I know this might be somewhat of a controversial take, but like whatever, the era of like the Black Panther Party, when it comes to education, when it comes to feeding each other, like the fact
you knew
that
I was gonna go there.
They were able to have kids come in the morning before school and you ate.
Yeah.
And then after school you came and your education was supplemented with further education with Black history, and then they fed them again, and like they really gave the people an opportunity to create with their community mm-hmm. and in turn society, their direct society looks like for them, for themselves. And when I think about the Obama era, obviously you think about the energy, mm-hmm. like people wanted to vote. People wanted to turn out. Mm-hmm. I remember the day, so my birthday is November 5th, so it's always on or around Election Day.
Yeah.
And Election Day was November 4th that year, for his first term. It was November 4th. And then on the 5th, it was like 1 a.m., 2 a.m. when they finally said, like, Barack Obama is going to be the next president.
That's a good
and me
gift.
And my sisters and my cousins, everybody was at my mom's house. My mom was in the bed and we all started like screaming and cheering. My mom thought something was wrong. So she like runs down the stairs with her bonnet on and her purse, like, what's wrong? Like thinking, you know, we're about to need to get up out of there. But just the excitement around that moment was really encouraging. Now it seems like when it's time to vote, people are like, ugh. Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Let's just see what happens. So, like, is that what you think about when you think about that era?
Well, I mean, that was the era that I experienced in my lifetime. You know, I'm still relatively young. I'm only 26.
Yeah,
so
I was going to say, how old are you then, Alex?
I haven't lived through very many presidencies. I've lived through, you know, some heavy presidencies.
Enough, right? Yeah. You lived through enough.
But not very many. Mm-hmm. When I think of Obama, I think of, you know, the primary between him and Hillary Clinton, two both very popular candidates, both very beloved, you know, in the communities that I'm part of. And I remember that energy that I saw on that debate stage. That is what got me as a little boy into politics. Mm-hmm. I remember I would be at my uncle's house on West Ferry talking to everyone about the election and what I saw in the debate and this and that. And it was just really exciting. And so for me, that was the moment that sort of captured me and scooped me in and, you know, retained my political interest, retained my engagement interest. Mm-hmm. And to know further on that Obama, you know, as my career progressed, Obama was a community organizer, mm-hmm. just like I was, you know, and then he went on to, mm-hmm. you know, run for various levels of government and then eventually become president. And so seeing Obama start off as a community organizer, somebody who grew up in a similar upbringing as myself, be able to ascend to that height sort of made me feel like this is something that everyday people can do.
Yeah, it made it achievable.
I think President Obama really represented the American dream, not only in the way that he got there, but also being someone that many people had been made to feel were less American. And so he defied that narrative. Mm-hmm. He engaged in the process, he won. And he set a tone for a lot of people that came after him. And I mean, democracy has its ups and downs. You know, different civilizations are always going to have their uprests. They're always going to have their times of turbulence. This is another, you know, time of turbulence that we're about to enter in that we now have to resolve. And it won't be the last. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's sometimes very scary for a lot of people to hear that it won't be the last. But that's why, you know, it's important for us, you know, as people that are like-minded, for one, to pace ourselves, two, make sure we're getting our rest, but then three, continue to find a reason to be engaged in this fight and in this movement so we can retain the same levels of motivation as we did during that ooh-ah moment like I had seeing President Obama when I was a little boy.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the Democratic Party. Do you feel like there is space carved out for Latino communities in the Democratic Party? Like, do you feel like sometimes I feel like there is no Black agenda for the Democratic Party? Like, they're not saying this group of people are living in a different, American experience than other people, so we need to target some of these specific issues. Do you feel like there is space carved out for Latino voters, the Latino experience, like issues that are unique to your community in the Democratic Party?
I think that there are many layers to that that have to be addressed. I will say progress has been made and progress looks different for different communities. And, you know, from being someone that's been engaged in this for quite some time now, I can see that sometimes progress can be very difficult to attain because a lot of it is you may have people that are interested, that want to get involved. But before you can get them to that point of being politically or civically engaged, you have to address other barriers that they experience in their life, mm-hmm. right? So for a lot of like the young people that I've gotten involved in different campaigns or learning the process, a lot of it was, okay, do you have a way to get there? Do you have food? Are you getting paid? You know, seeing if we can assess things like paid opportunities. is the literature speaking to your community, right? Mm-hmm. Are these things not only translated, but are they culturally relevant? Do they take into consideration social dynamics and power structures that exist within your community? And so I think when I, you know, do my own work of building the base and building up our people to be engaged, I have to be really intentional. And sometimes I think what our community struggles with is we don't always have enough people to carry forth this work.
Yeah. And I think part of it, too, is just an understanding that sometimes when there's not a place made for you, you make one. And like when my grandma marched with Martin Luther King, I don't know if anyone was courting her to be a Democratic Party member. Right. But I think it's really important for us to understand we were one of the reasons JFK got elected. We were the part of the reason why Clinton was elected. And when you look at the Democratic Party nationally in other states where there is higher Latino population that's concentrated, many people in the Democratic Party are Latino. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, I think of New Mexico, Joe. So for that reason, the state culture represents a different energy around party membership, right? So, you know, thinking about party membership or thinking about our Latino identity in context to New York and the incredible diverse culture we have here, you know, I think it's easy for many of us to feel like our voices are being lost in the shuffle because there are so many. Mm-hmm. But in other states where I've visited and there are others in the Latino Party, the Democratic Party and the Latino community who have reached levels of leadership, mm-hmm. which I think are really incredible.
Yeah. I remember in 2020, all summer, just trying to get people registered to vote, right?
Yeah.
And I remember standing under a tent on the corner of Jefferson and Utica, mm-hmm. grilling hot dogs to give people free food to,
yes.
to come over to us.
Let's go.
Right. And saying, like, you know, just so you know, in New York now, even if you have a felony conviction on your record, you can register to vote.
Incredible.
Right. And a lot of people didn't know that. A lot of people who were like, oh, I'm a Democrat, I didn't know I could vote. So do you think it should be the responsibility, or at least in part the responsibility, for the Democratic Party on a national level, on local levels, to help remove some of the barriers? Because we know these barriers exist. Like, you know, we grew up in Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Like, we face one barrier after another. So if I'm a Democratic candidate and I'm trying to get people to vote for me, should I also say, okay, I understand the barriers that people who I want to vote for me are facing. So instead of just trying to get their vote, I'm going to urge the party who's backing me potentially to help remove some of these barriers, whether it's information, whether it's just making sure people understand the voting process, understand why they should vote in the first place. Mm-hmm. Should the Democratic Party take some responsibility?
Do you want to answer first?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a whole rounded approach that can be taken from that, from a party perspective, and then also from an individual campaign perspective, right? Because the respective candidates who are running to represent their communities also have the deepest understanding of what it is that their voters are looking for or want to say, right? So like for me, whenever I go around and I'm getting a signature, I'm doing canvassing or whatever the case may be, I'm also, you know, engaging people in the process. I'm leaving flyers, I'm giving them informations or a QR code for them to scan of different resources that are available to them that are also translated in multiple languages. And then also building genuine connection outside. I don't just come around to a community when I need a signature. That's just not my thing. I mean, I come around and I knock on someone's door just because there's a block party happening down the street. And so I think being intentional about continuous engagement is incredibly important. And then also building relationships with people, right? Being open, accessible, transparent, that's really huge. A lot of times, you know, when I go and talk to people, if I'm getting a signature or I'm doing canvassing or whatever the case may be, I'm going to ask what matters to you. What is it that you want to see? What's working? What's not working? Take a note of that. Take their number and follow through. Follow through. And sometimes if you don't have an answer, at least right now, a commitment to finding one, right? Or a commitment to working together to make things better. But I think something that's going to be instrumental is going to be, as I mentioned, that general civic engagement. But neighborhood ownership is going to be really huge, right? As people decide and come together as to what their neighborhoods are going to look like, whether that be through revitalizing small business corridors to help employ more people in the area and to keep wealth in the community, whether it come through home ownership, all of these things add up and increase someone's ability to not only be civically engaged, but to continuously be able to vote and address the real issues that their communities are facing. So I think there's many approaches that could be taken in collaboration with different systems working together.
I love this answer, which is really, really good. And then I have just something to add to. And I know that I'm annoying because every time someone asks me a question, I answer about history. But succinctly, I don't know that they really know how to. Mm-hmm. I think, as Alex said, we know how to move our own community. And when I was doing my research about civil rights, Jill, I wanted to know who fed people. Right? Mm-hmm. Who was feeding people when they were coming into town? Who was moving people when we needed to move thousands of people? And those were mechanisms within our community. And I found stories of women who hosted like amazing, like 1,000 portion meals in their homes, right? But are those stories told, and do we feel ownership over those stories that we are the reason that this democracy stands and we know how to organize ourselves? Mm-hmm. So we need their help, but Joe, I don't know how much if we have the right resources. And then also, shout out to them, though. It's an amazing thing to be able to pick, right? Because I feel like in some places there's not as much choice. But the latter, I would say, where I do really agree is that I feel, and this may is also very like dorky, but like I feel that civic engagement or teaching political efficacy is something we should do in our schools. Mm-hmm. And that should be part of the message that our students receive. You are powerful, not only in this nation, but as a part of this school system. Mm-hmm. And these are the ways that your voices can be heard. And I feel like over time, when we create systems to support those young leaders, they advance and become those adults who are like, no, this, that. And to Alex's point, when we were talking about campaigns, I was like, we need a car. Mm-hmm. Like, we need people to pick people up. Mm-hmm. Because I know people in my family need to be picked up for the polls. So
transportation's huge.
You know, I think just balancing it with tapping into that knowledge that is really in our communities, but maybe, as to your prior point, not often told, and then also creating a generation that feels capable.
Yeah. And speaking of our future generations, do you think they're being energized enough? And I don't mean, you know, bringing Megan Thee Stallion out to a campaign stop and performing a song. I mean, do they have enough? Are they being given a reason to hope, a reason to say that even though right now we're entering one of those periods of turmoil, I'm going to still have faith that in 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years from now, things won't look and feel like this. Mm. Are they being given a reason to even think that going out to the polls and voting is worth it?
I think that a lot of people in our community are just trying to survive today and are just trying to survive each and every day. And so I don't think that a lot of them, you know, have the life circumstances to be able to think that far out. But when you talk to them and build those relationships, they are very passionate about issues. And so, especially when I'm talking to Hispanic youth and youth of color in general, having a more issue-based approach and conversation as opposed to talking about the politics of it all and the system in general tends to be more effective. And, you know, when you see that passion, then it's how do we create that access for them to actually be involved, right? That can be through things like offering, paid campaign opportunities. A lot of our youth want to work in these things. A lot of our youth want to learn what the process looks like. But again, many of our youth are going to high school or going to college and then going straight to a job right afterwards. Mm-hmm. Sometimes maybe at hours that don't align with their school schedule or, you know, they may have a gap in their schedule and they only have so much time to rest, or they're quite literally going from school, getting on a bus and then going straight to an overnight job. I've seen that before. So the conversation needs to start as to what is it that you care about and understanding them as who they are as individuals. And then from there, once you have that and you understand what it is that they're interested in, what they care about, create that access.
So I would say, as a mom to my 7-year-old Latino son, I explained to him that there are people with the very same name as him standing in a field, right, who may be 12 years old, and they share common identities. So, you know, everybody's America, in my view, Jill, is important. But I think when we talk about the Latino community, there are certain privileges that my son has and lives that I want him to be very aware are not the same for everyone in Generation Alpha that was born in between 2000 and 2024. And my further point, you are one of the reasons they are energized. Literally, as you asked that question, I was like, it's so crazy for her to ask this question because I've seen you energize people in our city. But their relationship with Americanism and then also with technology. Mm-hmm. How is the technology that we're introducing to them impacting their self-esteem? How is it impacting their understanding of what their version of America is? And also, how will it better prepare them for the workforce? So I love that question. And I want to say succinctly, you are one of the reasons they are inspired. And that's an honest answer.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I do think it's important that we put a lot of energy behind not just energizing youth to want to go vote, but making sure that they understand that it's worth it. Mm-hmm. You know, even when you talk about, I have so many younger cousins, kids that I work with, this most recent election, they're like, well, we don't ultimately decide who wins anyway. So why even bother? So while I feel like, obviously, as citizens, we take accountability and responsibility for that, just like in a succinct yes or no, do you think that the Democratic Party, who want these votes, who need people to come out and vote, can do more?
Always, yes. Always, we can always improve. Yeah. I think we always, as Americans, should have that perspective.
So let's talk about something a little bit more recent. Recently, November 5th, my poor birthday, we had an election. And Donald Trump became the nominee for the next president. And he now is the president again. Mm-hmm. When you look at the voter trends, like, it kind of, they try to break it down by demographics. So, like, Black women voted for such and such. White women voted for such and such. I feel like a lot of people were shocked at the amount of Latino voters in general who voted for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Why do you think he got their vote? Like, what was it that they were able to connect to say, this is in my best interest?
Do you want to go first?
I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, from the data captured from Univision, up to 60% of them were not necessarily committed to any party, right? Mm-hmm. And so they became this segment of voters that either candidate or either party, you know, could have essentially scooped up should their platform have resonated with those voters. But, you know, as Talia had mentioned, the biggest issue for them was the economy. I also think, too, if you're looking at the timeline of the election, our vice president did not have enough time to properly, you know, lay out a campaign for each individual community as Trump did, you know, because Trump was doing interviews on Univision before she became the nominee, correct? And so it put her to a disadvantage because she was now not only having a campaign full steam ahead, but she wouldn't have been able to lay out what I'm sure would have probably been her original vision and plan. And we saw in response to, you know, the comments that were made about Puerto Rico at one of Trump's rallies in Madison Square Garden, our vice president in that moment very diligently expressed her commitment to our community and uplifting our community and crafting a vision for our community and with our community in solidarity with our community, given the timeline. So I really think a lot of it was just the timing of it all and the way that everything went down.
And that will do it for today's edition of Producer Picks Best of the Week. We thank our guests, Dr. Annette Wasacki, Alex Burgos, and Talia Rodriguez. If you missed anything, or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.